Secretary of the Methodist Church, the Reverend Dr. Martin Atkins. Here on FM, it's our Book of the Week. Drawing on his experience as a performer and his background as a scholar, the internationally renowned tenor Ian Bostridge reads from his book on Franz Schubert's song cycle masterpiece, Winter Journey. Today's episode opens with Song 17, Der Wegweiser.
Was vermeid ich denn die Wege, wo die anderen...
November the 12th, 1828. Schubert's last letter. Dear Schober, I am ill. I've eaten nothing for 11 days and drunk nothing, and I totter feebly and shakily from my chair to bed and back again. Rinna is treating me. If I ever take anything, I bring it up again at once. Be so kind, then, as to assist me in this desperate situation by means of literature. Of Cooper's I have read The Last of the Mohicans, The Spy, The Pilot, and The Pioneers. If by any chance you have anything else of his, I implore you to deposit it with Frau von Burgner at the coffee house for me. My brother, who is conscientiousness itself, will most faithfully pass it on to me. Your friend, Schubert. Schubert reading The Last of the Mohicans on his deathbed, in the midst of correcting the proofs for Winterreiser, this has always been a wonderfully human picture for me. In the midst of illness, what could have been more distracting than to devour tales of the adventurous West? A craze for the novels of James Fenimore Cooper swept Europe in the 1820s. In Cooper's primeval forests, with their heroic natives and rough-hewn colonists, the so-called European tiredness of the time could find refreshment in an open and invigorating atmosphere. In relation to Winterreiser, I think of the wanderer alone in his wilderness, staring at the Wegweiser, signpost but literally path-teller, and am reminded of the frontiersman Hawkeye, hero of The Last of the Mohicans. There remains an aura of Rousseau-esque noble savagery about both Hawkeye and the Mohican Chingachgook, with Hawkeye representing an ideal synthesis of natural and civilised humanity. He navigates his landscape, he owns it, is at one with it, and knows his way about in it. Not for nothing is one of his nicknames Pathfinder. He stands in clearest opposition to the alienated European, to Winterreiser's outcast, wandering about, sonder Maßen ohne Ruhe und Suche Ruhe, without measure, without peace, and seeking peace. One of my earliest professional performances of Winterreiser took place in the Conway Hall in the mid-1990s. At the time, performing this particular cycle in this particular hall was especially piquant, it seemed to me, because Conway Hall, 25 Red Lion Square, bang in the centre of London, had been since 1928 the seat of the South Place Ethical Society. It claims to be the oldest organisation in the world devoted to the promotion of free thought, having grown out of a dissident nonconformist congregation which refused to subscribe to the orthodox doctrines of hellfire and eternal punishment. This group first acquired premises in Bishopsgate in 1793, a dangerous year for radicalism, as a reactionary British government began to clamp down on anything that smacked of French freethinking and the horror of revolution. Schubert was born in 1797. Just as the intellectual and institutional antecedents of the South Place Ethical Society were beginning their long march from heterodoxy to humanism. He lived his life in a period of intense crisis for the nature of religious belief. By the beginning of the 19th century, study of the earth was undermining biblical chronology, establishing a notion of deep time which would eventually enable Darwin's devastating blow against the old doctrines of creation, as well as the argument from design. Schubert's own upbringing was conventionally religious. He was a professional composer, living in a devout society, and it is difficult to imagine that any classical composer, well into the 20th century and beyond, would not have been involved in the composition of sacred music. But Winterreiser dramatises the predicament of the human being alone in the world, searching for meaning, whether it be in the bosom of Abraham or within the human community standing proudly self-sufficient. Schubert is experimenting with a world in which not only love, but God and meaning are lost. Song 24, Der Leiermann, the Hurdy-Gurdy Man. Over there behind the village stands a hurdy-gurdy man, and with numb fingers he grinds away as best he can. Barefoot on the ice he sways back and forth, and his little plate remains always empty. No one wants to hear him, no one looks at him, and the dogs growl around the old man. There is a romantic irony embedded in the very title of the final poem, Der Leiermann. The lyre, in German, or lyre in English, was the most romantic of instruments. Lyres were everywhere in this period, embossed in gold on the leather covers of the commonplace books of teenage girls, adorning innumerable pieces of Biedermeier furniture in respectable bourgeois establishments, and dignifying John Keats's grave in the English cemetery at Rome. So how fabulously apt it would have been to have ended this cycle with a lyre song. How poignant, how poetic, how decent. This, however, is not a lyre at all, but a vulgar, indecent hurdy-gurdy, a rotating or turning lyre, the chosen instrument of the musically unaccomplished beggar, the lowest of the low. The hurdy-gurdy is the fiddler's version of the bagpipe. The soundbox can be that of a fiddle, a guitar, or a lute, but the strings are neither plucked nor bowed. Instead, a wooden wheel, coated in resin, acts as a sort of never-ending bow, setting the strings vibrating as it is turned by a crank at the end of the instrument. As a result, the hurdy-gurdy can be thought of as mechanised and dissociating, the perfect instrument for the expression of alienation. The old hurdy-gurdy was gradually replaced by the Drehorgel, or barrel organ, in a process of transformation which left the vocabulary a little confused and overlapping. When Bertolt Brecht and Kurt Weill in their Threepenny Opera wanted to create an opera for beggars on the stage of a Berlin theatre in 1928, they launched it with a ballad sung in a cracked voice to the accompaniment of a Leierkasten, a cheap street organ. I like to think of their ballad singer, whose ballad of Mac the Knife I sometimes sing, as sinister first cousin to Schubert's Leiermann. Styles of singing are convention-bound. They are heard by listeners as natural or mannered only within context. The simple classical delivery of a folk song by a trained voice may sound uptight and artificial to an audience used to hearing Barbara Allen or O Waley Waley in the nasal twang that has become associated with an authentic folk voice. Crossing boundaries is perilous, and on the whole, opera singers sound as wrong in pop music as pop singers do in German song. One of the rare times when I was conscious of somehow channeling another species of musical expression was when I was performing Winterreise in Moscow. I've often reimagined Der Leiermann as a sort of Bob Dylan song, best delivered outside the classical norms of singing. In practice, it had never seemed that easy to achieve the requisite vibe. On this occasion, somehow it clicked, a connection made with the greatest Dylan love song performance on record, the bitter masterpiece Don't Think Twice, It's All Right. Schubert's Hurdy-Gurdy Man emerged as a song which was hardly sung at all, rasping and guttural by the standards of bel canto, but at the same time not impossibly at odds with what had gone before, and not a ridiculous intrusion of pop singing into the classical sound world. At least I hope not. I have no idea if Bob Dylan was himself aware of Winterreise. Given his cultural eclecticism in the 1960s, swerving in imaginative intoxication between Rambo, Brecht, Elvis, and the Beat Poets, it's not such an outlandish suggestion. There is a definite kinship between Schubert's hurdy-gurdy player and Dylan's tambourine man. It's not a million miles from his jingle-jangle to Schubert's hurdy-gurdy. Miller's final poem can only have struck a particular chord in Schubert because he, too, was a musician. As he told his friend Eduard Bauernfeld, "I already see you as a court counsellor and as a famous writer of comedies. But I? What's to become of a poor musician like me? I expect I shall have to slink up to doors in my old age like Goethe's harper and beg for bread." There had long been something disreputable about being a musician. During the Middle Ages, instrumentalists had been viewed as incompetent in many legal matters, unable to be judges, witnesses, or jurors, ineligible for land tenure, unable to serve as guardians or to hold civic office, not accepted by the trade guilds, with no right to normal damages as plaintiffs in a civil case. Laws changed, but the stigma remained, allied to the deep-rooted suspicion of the rootless and of those whose musical activities verged on the mystical, the magical, and the shamanic demonic. The tale of the Pied Piper of Hamelin cast a long shadow. Schubert's own awareness of his liminal status, half-genius, half-hired hand, can only have been intensified by the novelty of his situation. He was nobody's lackey. Schubert is crucial as the first of the canonical great composers to have made his living without a patron, a position in the court or church, or a musical sinecure of any sort. At the same time, he was a creature of the marketplace. Miller's hurdy-gurdy player then must have made an especial appeal to a composer and musician living on the threshold of modernity, all too conscious of the dangers of falling into the terrifying state of indigence that the old man represents. There is nowhere for the singer to hide in this stark confrontation with emptiness. What happens after a performance of Winterreiser is a little mysterious, but usually follows a pattern. Silence emerges as the last hurdy-gurdy phrase dissipates into the hall, a silence which is often extended and forms part of the shared experience of the piece, a silence performed as much by the audience as it is by singer and pianist. A mute, stunned applause usually follows, which can swell into noisier acclaim. The normal rules of the song recital are in abeyance. No encores are prepared or expected, and however enthusiastically the audience respond, none will be forthcoming. There's a sense of seriousness, of having encountered something above and beyond, something ineffable and untouchable. There can also be a sense of embarrassment or awkwardness between audience and performers, which the applause does its best, eventually, to eradicate. A song cycle such as Winterreiser is not rooted in aspects of sung or musical performance which tend to create a certain awestruck distance. Virtuosity is concealed. Vocalism does not unduly draw attention to itself, even ironizes itself. And the audience member must almost feel that he or she too is singing, and hence is implicated in the subjectivity which is being projected. So, having gone so deeply into difficult places, having confronted each other across the footlights and opened up our vulnerabilities over what, at 70 minutes, is a considerable time span, a return to normality can feel unapproachable. End-of-concert rituals can help, or they can impede. Sometimes it feels impossible to do the customary things. Meet friends, have a drink, eat a meal. Solitude may beckon.
Ian Bostridge was reading and performing Schubert's Winter Journey. The pianist was Leif Ufer Ansnes. The book was abridged by Lawrence Waring and produced by Kirstine Cameron.
BBC Radio 4 Extra celebrates the life and work of Elizabeth Jane Howard.
And you'd hear the mad clatter of the typewriter keys, and then she would emerge an hour later having written, you know, twice as much as my father would in a whole day.
Featuring a new interview with her stepson Martin Amis, and readings from her best-selling novels.
The illusion that eating in the open air constitutes at least one aspect of the simple life is ancient and enduring.
Elizabeth Jane Howard Remembered, a three-hour special, tomorrow morning at 9 and again in the evening at 7, over on BBC Radio 4 Extra.